Okay, so we're back, and what I'm going to do now is provide you with some review for the final exam, or not the final, sorry, for exam one, which is due on October 23rd at 8 p.m. Of course, it's due electronically, and you should submit that the same way that you've been submitting your reading responses. Okay, and of course, if you have any questions, you can email me, and I'll try to get back to you as soon as possible. Remember that you're to provide a one-page response for any of the three of the questions that I provided. Right, one-page response per question. I know there was some question about that. So, yeah, I'm sorry that it's been a little ambiguous. I'll try to be more clear in the future. At any rate, so question number one. Right, explain the difference between quantitative and qualitative hedonism. Why does Mill believe Bentham's view is inadequate? Is Mill right about Bentham's view? If so, why? If not, why not? Okay, so what are the differences between quantitative and qualitative hedonism? Well, here what you should remember is that you're going to have to, you know, obviously demonstrate what the differences are, right? So all of my questions will be like this, no matter whether you're writing a term paper for me or whether you're, you know, writing an exam or turning in a reading response. What I'm looking for students to do is provide me with some explanation of what a given theory says, right? Now, obviously, before you can say anything about a theory, you're going to have to get the theory right, right? And so all of my questions are structured such that there's a theoretical component that you've got to get, you know, down. You've got to have it down cold so that you can then later evaluate the theory in a meaningful way, right? So in other words, if you're off target when you're sort of unpacking what a given theory will say, you're going to be off target in your evaluation, right? So there's no way to properly evaluate a theory until you properly understand that theory. And so that's absolutely critical, right? And so those students who are able to do to outline a given theory properly will obviously be able to then properly evaluate that theory, and those students will do much better than others will. Okay, so again, let's get back to the question. What is the difference between quantitative and qualitative hedonism? Well, the difference comes down to how these different accounts basically measure the quality or the quantity of a given experience. Now, remember that Bentham believed that it was possible to track or to measure a given experience by multiplying. Imagine having a pleasurable experience, maybe chewing a Starburst, or you know, having sexual relations with your favorite person, or whatever it might be. Right. So, what I want to do, maybe skydiving or playing football, playing in the Super Bowl or whatever it might be. What Bentham suggested was that I would need to multiply the intensity of the experience, right? Some experiences are more intense than others, right? So I multiply the intensity of a given experience by the duration, right? Some experiences last longer than others do. So I multiply the intensity times the duration of a given experience, and that will yield some product, right? And if I'm measuring pleasure in this case, then I would have some indication of just how pleasurable an experience was. And of course, I could do the same for painful experiences, right? I could measure the intensity of a given pain times the duration of a given pain, and that would also yield some product. What I could do is then measure the difference, right? I could subtract all of my painful experiences from my pleasurable ones, and that would tell me whether or not my life on the whole is more pleasurable than painful, right? Now, this was Bentham's approach. And of course, it's called quantitative hedonism because what is he doing? He's measuring quantities, right? The upshot, though, of Bentham's view is that he's going to have to talk about experiences in terms of units of quantity, right? So a given one, you know, chewing a Starburst might have 5 units of pleasure in it. Stubbing your toe might have, you know, 5 units of pain, right? And so if I were to chew a Starburst and then stub my toe, I'd be at a wash for the day, right? So I'm at zero, right? In other words, the stubbing my toe negated the pleasure that I was experiencing while chewing a Starburst. So what's the upshot? Well, the upshot is that Bentham treats experiences as consisting of units. And of course, unit for unit, all experiences will be the same. That is to say, all pleasurable experiences will be the same. and all painful experiences will be the same. Unit for unit. Now, that's a very important distinction to keep in mind, right? It's unit for unit. Not that all pleasures will be the same, but that all pleasures unit for unit will be the same. Okay, now what will this mean? Well, Mill thinks it will mean that we will be unable, if we become quantitative hedonists, we'll be unable to make differentiations in kinds of experience, or in other words, qualities of experience, right? So what is it that distinguishes between a high quality experience and a low quality experience? Now, if you remember, there's a passage in chapter 2 that I read having to do with a pig, right? And Mill says, you know, none of us would be willing to trade our lives. No thoughtful human being would ever trade their life for the life of a pig, or the fullest allowance of a beast's pleasures, or whatever it is, right? And he says, look, it's better to be a fool, better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. Better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied, right? So what does that mean? Well, it seems to mean this, right? We acknowledge that the pig can have high quantities of pleasure, right? Rolling in the mud, eating slop, right? High quantities of pleasure, the pig really enjoys himself. Yet none of us are willing to trade our lives for the life of the pig. Why is that? Well, it's because we believe that the pig is only having low quality experiences, right? While we're able to have higher quality experiences, right? What can I do? Well, I can read a novel, right? Can read Harry Potter. I can go see a movie. I can come to class and learn new things, right? And the pig can't do any of that. So I can seek high quality pleasures, whereas a pig has to be satisfied with very low quality pleasures, right? And so obviously we need a way of taking into account the quality of given pleasures, right? And this is why Mill becomes or offers us qualitative hedonism as an alternative to quantitative hedonism. So it will be up to you to determine which theory is better and why, and to outline each possibility. Okay. Question number 2. Welfarists believe only well-being has intrinsic value. All other goods are instrumentally valuable. Explain the distinction between intrinsic and instrumental value. Are there good reasons for believing the welfarist? If so, what are those reasons? If not, explain why the welfarist is wrong. Okay, so welfarism, of course, is the view that says only well-being is intrinsically valuable, and all other goods are only instrumentally valuable. What's the distinction between an instrumental and an intrinsic good? Remember, here we're talking about things that are intrinsically valuable as having value all on their own, right? They don't have to appeal to anything else for their value. Instrumental goods, things that are instrumentally valuable, we think are valuable because of their ability to bring about some other desired good, right? And so that's basically the distinction there. Should we believe the welfarist? Well, what kinds of arguments could be offered, right? This is something you're going to have to think about. Obviously there's a kind of reduction going on. The welfarist wants to say, you know, why do you care about education? Well, and you might respond by saying, well, I care about education because, you know, I want to be able to, you know, get a good job. Well, why do you care about getting a good job? Well, I want to get a good job so I can, you know, buy certain things and have a family one day. Well, why do you want to buy things and why do you want a family? Well, I guess I want to have a family so I'll be happy, right? So that's what I mean by reduction, right? There's a kind of reduction that all of the things that you care about in your life, you care about, the welfarist wants to say, is because that's what is entailed in having well-being, right? Having having children, or having a spouse, or having a car, or having a house, right? All of those things are ingredients in what it means to live well. But none of them are actually what it means to live well, right? They're all part of what it means to live well, but none of them is itself living well. I can have a house and still not be living well. I can have a spouse and still not be living well. But, you know, taking all of these things together, right, what I want to say is that I have well-being. So those are some of the reasons. Now, if you don't want to go with a welfarist, you'll have to come up with some alternative, right? If you think there are other things that are intrinsically valuable besides well-being, then you would become a pluralist, right? And there, so you'd have to offer an argument for why other things, other than well-being, are intrinsically valuable, right? And that can be done. You know, it's not that the welfarist has, knockdown argument for why we shouldn't consider other things being intrinsically valuable. So give that some thought. All right, let's move on to question number three then. In class, we discussed a number of objections to utilitarianism. Explain the difference between the problem of honest mistakes and the problem of calculation. Which is a more serious problem for utilitarianism and why? Okay. So again, in this case, you'll want to return to those lectures where I outlined the differences, or when I talked about the problem of honest mistakes. Remember, the problem of honest mistakes has to do with the Hitler case that I explained. The problem of calculation has to do with the problem of time, right? So that's the major distinction. We're talking about making mistakes in calculations as opposed to time, the time needed to make a calculation. Okay? So that's the primary difference, and you'll want to outline what those differences are and possible solutions to those differences, or to those problems. Number four, then. As discussed in class, well, of course we don't have class, but as discussed in lecture, many critics have suggested that utilitarianism does not give proper weight to the rules of morality. What does this mean? Does it constitute a significant problem for utilitarianism? Why or why not? Okay. Now in this case, we're dealing with not the problem of honest mistakes or the problem of calculation, we're dealing with the problem of permitting too much, right? Not giving sufficient weight, or in other words, not taking the rules of morality serious enough, okay? And of course, you'll want to explain what that means, and you may even want to consider the Darcy case that I explained, okay? And whether or not this constitutes a significant problem for utilitarianism, okay? All right, finally, number five, explain the difference between act and rule utilitarianism. Which view is better and why? Support your answer with reasons, okay? Here, of course, you just want to appeal to lecture number seven. Right at the very end of that lecture, I talk about the differences between act and rule utilitarianism. The main thing you want to keep in mind, of course, is the different normative accounts that act and rule utilitarians provide. Of course, they both provide the same foundational account, but they have different normative accounts of how the rule should be applied. One other thing to keep in mind is that act utilitarians think of the rules of morality as guidelines to what will most likely promote well-being, while rule utilitarians think of the rules of morality as the best indicators of what will promote well-being. Okay? All right, so that's our review for the first exam. If you have questions beyond what I've been able to answer here, certainly email me or give me a call, and I'll try to help you. All right, take care and good luck.